Yep, my name's Dave Rowntree, and by day I'm the drummer in Blur. By night I'm the front man in my own self-titled organisation. And I have an album out in January.
If we were sitting together at the pub, I would say to you, really? You woke up one morning and said, you know, I've sat behind the kit. I've done this for decades. I'm going to try this myself. What goes through your mind and what level of sanity is involved?
I guess the background is I've been a songwriter for, you know, all my life. I used to, as a kid, I would write the songs for the bands I played in. And I've carried on doing that for fun. About 10 years ago, I started working in the film industry as a composer. And that career has picked up quite substantially. And now I've done some interesting jobs and I'm kind of I'm at the middle of the middle rung of the middle ladder with all of that. You know, I'm kind of my composing is reasonably well known now, and that kind of gave me the confidence really to take things to the next stage with my songs, and of course it's also given me a recording studio which I could actually do the work in. So I took a bunch of songs. I wrote about, 5 years ago, probably, maybe a little less, 4 or 3 years ago. And I was, I had a friend of mine, Leo Abrams, the producer, and we had a vague plan of doing it together. And then everything got squashed by the pandemic. And so all of our plans went awry, but I was still carrying on doing some film work. I probably did the last TV series that got shot, that was in the can before the pandemic hit and the lockdown started. So my first lockdown was spent doing the, you know, all the post-production team moved into their respective houses, including me, and so I carried on working on that. But then the second lockdown happened and that was nothing. You know, the film industry ground to a halt. Leo and I were stuck in our respective studios, unable to be together to do this work. So we said, I'll tell you what, we can't make the album, but we'll just do some preparatory work now, you know, a bit of editing and get all the Logic sessions set up and all of that kind of thing. And then when we're free again after the lockdowns, we'll make the record. Well, of course, inevitably, 6 weeks later, after deciding to do some preparatory work, the album was finished. And it turned out to be a very, very efficient way of working, each in our respective studios. We had to get some kind of collaboration tools going and that kind of thing, but it all worked out really well.
So your dad, tell the listeners, because, you know, everybody who asks you this, they're like, well, RAF. But explain to them what the RAF is.
Yes, well, he was in the Air Force as a young man. So, but he wasn't a pilot. He was a technician, a radio engineer. That was his trade. And so he used to teach the pilots their technical radio courses. You know, you need to learn how to operate the plane, all its various bits and bobs, if you want to be a pilot. And so he used to teach them the radio aspects. And one thing he used to say was he would teach the pilots how to mend their radios if they got shot down to summon help. That was one part of his course. But anyway, he learned a lot about radio and a lot about electronics in the Air Force. And so that he passed that on to me. That was his gift to me, really. So as a kid, where many dads and sons would go and watch football or go fishing, you know, he and I would sit around the kitchen table with soldering irons, building radios, and then plugging them into an antenna in the back garden and spinning the dial and listening to tuning in stations from all over the world.
You know, you think about today and you think, oh, we've got streaming and we've got the internet. And you know what? You and I, we had the internet way before the internet existed. When you come right down to it, he's like, oh, I can listen to a station in South Africa. Well, guess what? You always could. So maybe we're just, I don't know if we're just a little bit jaded, or maybe we're just kind of appreciative of the fact of what we had and most people didn't.
Well, it's given you on a plate these days, isn't it? It's much, much easier. For us, it was, certainly for me, it was astonishing that I could, you know, with a simple bit of equipment, tune in stations from Australia and, you know, the Middle East and Africa and all these different places. It just seemed magical to me. And it was quite, I was very precious. You know, I loved it. I had a radio by my bedside growing up as a kid, and I would, yeah, you know, in the night when I should have been asleep, I would, you know, have my earphones in and I would be listening to stations from all around the world, dreaming of these kind of exotic places with their exotic languages and crazy music, you know. And that was quite a really beautiful experience. But these things always change. I'm not nostalgic about those days. It's far easier to do that now, and that's a good thing, not a bad thing. Yes. You know, so
yes.
But for the generation today, that's no longer a magical thing, you know. They probably wouldn't even wonder why we thought that was bizarre, you know, because they've grown up being able to speak on little plastic boxes they keep in their pocket with anybody from all over the world.
You know, being in a very small town and the world coming to you must have been even more influential than had you been growing up, you know, in the East End.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a small town, but it had a small town mentality, you know, and it's one of these places that it's a town near a big city. It's under 100 miles from London. So it was always in London's shadow, you know, and if you were successful there, you would just move to London. Why wouldn't you? You know, so it had constantly the cream of the talent was being skimmed off the top constantly, you know. And so it felt very, very suffocating to me. So I was determined to be one of those, moved to London rather shamefully, really. But I was determined that I wasn't going to sit in the place that nobody else wanted to be in. I was, as soon as was humanly possible, I was going to leave.
I look at how my politics are, you know, based on my parents, but you had Radio Moscow. And Radio Moscow, I mean, back then, the Cold War in full force.
Well, I came from a very conventional family in some respects and very unconventional in a lot of other respects. But anyway, in terms of the kind of political outlook, my dad, after he left the RAF, he joined the BBC, which is a very kind of straight-laced organisation, and we got the kind of centre-right newspapers. So I was getting a very homogenous view of the world and what it all meant. And the radio was kind of my political awakening, really. Listening to foreign news stations like Radio Moscow and others, I had that light bulb moment that actually there can be more than one interpretation of world events. Obviously, the Radio Moscow one was fairly berserk and not entirely convincing, but interesting that you could have the same events and yet draw a different narrative between them. And many countries' national broadcasters used to do English language news to kind of, you know, as part of their soft power efforts to get their views out across the world. And they were all on long wave in those days, and it was interesting to listen to them all. As I say, that started my kind of lurch to the left, really. That was where I left the centre-right politics of my parents behind, that was kind of my political awakening, really.
This has been in your heart and soul since you were listening to Radio Moscow, I would say. It's just that the middle age crisis is a great excuse to put that into play. Am I right there? Do you agree with that?
Certainly there's something about being in a band that it doesn't scratch all the itches, you know, because it's when you're, you know, I think music can be absolutely transformative and have the power to do such good in people's lives. The problem is, as a successful musician in a band, you don't really see that. You know, when you're making the records, you're in the studio, you're hermetically sealed off from the world, you know, and you certainly don't see people when they pull their record out of the sleeve and play it for the first time, or, you know, they log into their favourite streaming service and play your album for the first time. You don't see that moment. Equally on stage, again, when you're in a successful band, you're playing in front of a lot of people. It's quite an odd position to be in. I really like it, but it's kind of odd. You know, you walk on stage and people scream. I mean, they don't do that in the supermarket, you know, not often anyway. What I found I was missing was that kind of one-on-one kind of interaction with people, you know, helping people, looking people in the eye, asking them if they're okay, that kind of thing. I found I was craving. And so many of the other things I've done in my life have been to kind of put that back in, you know. So I did it in several ways. I got involved with the Labour Party in the UK, and I've done lots of different things, lots of really interesting and worthwhile things for the Labour Party, which mostly involved knocking on people's doors and asking if they're all right. I mean, that's my kind of politics, really. You go around your house, knock on your door and ask if there's anything I can do to help. Also, I became a criminal lawyer. I practiced at that for about 5 years. That was another incredible, very interesting thing to do. Met a lot of people I wouldn't have otherwise met. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing when you're a criminal lawyer, I don't know. But many of the people I met had done what they were accused of being of doing. But you know, it's a question of trying to navigate them through the legal process. You know, they might end up in prison. That's a very scary thought for many people, and rightly so. It can be a very dangerous place. So, you know, all of that, just being there for them, just kind of supporting them, not being judgmental. That's, again, incredibly rewarding. Sometimes it's not rewarding. 4 a.m. when you're called out to a police station to represent somebody who's, you know, coming down from drugs and has done something awful. That's not life-affirming. You know, I've met some serial killers. That wasn't particularly life-affirming. Interesting how nice the serial killers tend to be.
You bring what you know and what you love to what you do. But in this particular case, the mix of listening to the radio late at night, the mix of movies, this is a very media-centric kind of record. You're bringing people, you know, a lot of visuals and a lot of sound and a lot of layers. So when you were working with Lee and you're talking about this record, what did you had songs, obviously, but what did you say to each other, being that you both do what you do for a living, in kind of, you know, worlds that overlap each other?
It's always difficult talking about music, you know, even with other musicians. That's really yes. The hardest thing. So really, you've just got to do. But I'd recorded a lot of noise from in between the stations on the radio, static going on in between the stations. There's all kinds of other, you know, machines talking to machines, or humans communicating with each other via different media, or there's naturally occurring sounds, you know. So yes. So I've just recorded hours and hours and hours of all this stuff, and what Leo and I did was use that as the basis for the sounds of many of the songs. So, you know, when you do something like that, it sets you off in a certain direction, and you don't need to discuss that direction. So so that was really that was the foundation for why the record sounds like it sounds. It's all of that stuff in between the stations.
You know, one of the things you've talked about is the confidence in the music and coming up front. So I'm always fascinated, where was that moment, whether you're writing or whether you're, you know, starting to produce this, that you said, you know, I actually like this. I've got something here, and I can step back from it and realize why? Or have you ever actually done that?
I went through a variety of phases, you know. It's kind of it's difficult to sustain self-belief unless you're an absolute nutcase. It's difficult to sustain self-belief in a project like this over a long period of time. So I just had to have faith, really, you know, faith that things were going to turn out okay in the end. And that's my fundamental belief with music. is if you get the songs right, everything falls quite naturally into place. It may take time, but somehow or other, it's all going to fall quite naturally into place. And I knew the songs were good. I knew it was. I knew there was something there. I was quite proud of what I'd done with those. And I worked with some great people on some of them as well. It was collaborations. On HK, bizarrely, I found some audio on the internet, which was a YouTube video of a woman giving somebody a massage, but she had such a lovely voice. So anyway, I downloaded it, cut it all up, made it into a little story, and then I got a singer friend of mine to come in and redo it all. So that was that. But the HK, the song, was written in Hong Kong. It went through a variety of stages, that one. It started out as something else completely different, inspired by the kind of frenetic pace of Chinese radio. It is interesting how the stations kind of reflect the national character, really. And, you know, when you listen to American radio versus English radio, it's breathless, the pace of American radio. But the Chinese Chinese radio is the same again. You know, it's the same leap forward into... And I think... one of the reasons it sounds like that is because I don't understand the language, you know. The musical vocabulary as well for more traditional Chinese music. But that the city against that sonic backdrop really was what inspired HK. Thousand Miles was written by a friend of mine, Hogni. He and I wrote the song in Iceland. He's an Icelandic musician, and there's a really famous studio in Iceland that we hired out for a couple of days and wrote that song together around a piano and a drum kit. So that was really exciting. That's worked really well, I think.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich, and what it is two of your songs as the bread and songs by others in between.